Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 176, I chat with Brent Butterworth, Jeffrey Morrison, and Mark Henninger about the Cedia Expo 2013 convention that we all just returned from. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded September 30th, 2013, episode 176, Cedia 2013 wrap up. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by iFixit. You can fix it. And iFixit makes it easy with step-by-step repair guides, high-quality replacement parts, and all the tools you'll need. For $10 off your purchase of $50 or more, go to iFixit.com/twit and enter the code HTG at checkout. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and director of content at avsforum.com. This week, I bring you three journalists, and all four of us were at the Cedia trade show last week in Denver, Colorado. So we've got plenty of stuff to talk about. First up is Brent Butterworth. He's the Stereos Guide at About.com. Hey, Brent, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Scott, good to be back.
Thank you so much for being here. Next, we have Jeff Morrison, a freelancer and bon vivant, who contributes to CNET, Forbes, and Wirecutter, among many other outlets. Hey, Jeff, welcome back.
Hey, Scott, how's it going?
Good, thanks. Thanks so much for being here. And finally, we have Mark Henninger, social media manager and newsbreaker at avsforum.com. We work together very closely. In fact, he shot all the video interviews that we did during Cedia, which number something like 40 or 45, I think, at last count. Hey, Mark, welcome back.
Hey, Scott, thanks. And it's nice to see you again.
It is nice to see you, too. You and I spent most of Cedia almost joined at the hip, or at least joined by a microphone cable. I thank you so much for the great work that you did there. It was your first Cedia, wasn't it?
It was my first show, and I was really very impressed.
It's quite impressive. And you know, Brent and Jeff and I, you know, we've been going for many years, so I found it quite refreshing to sort of have your eyes on things and ears too as a newbie at the show. So I was very grateful for that.
There were definitely a number of things that I wanted to see that I finally got to see for the first time.
Exactly, which we will talk about during the next hour. Now, those of you who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for us as we go, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, first of all, I wanted to get your guys' hit on the general mood or tone at the show. I mean, I remember in 2008 and 9, that show seemed pretty down. And, you know, the economy was down and everything was had problems. Brent, let's start with you. What was your overall impression of the mood of the attendees and the exhibitors at the show?
Well, I thought it was moderately upbeat. It was maybe a hair better than I expected. You know, a few people complained that attendance wasn't so great. But, you know, there's always some people that complain that attendance isn't so great.
Well, sure. You'd like it to be a lot bigger than it was always, I guess. But,
you know, if you don't have any hot products in your booth, you're not going to have as many people coming by, right?
Right. So, yeah, exactly.
But I thought, you know, I just saw the Cedia figures. They just sent them out this morning, and it was attendance was up by a little bit. There were a lot of new people there, I think. That was my perception anyway. I saw a lot of people in the booth that clearly didn't have the level of expertise. And that's good because that means people are coming into the industry and it's growing.
If
it's just the old veterans, then it's not a growing industry, right?
So, Jeff, I remember you mentioning to me at dinner one night that you were a little concerned that there weren't more young people coming up into the industry, in particular in the press corps, which you and I belong to and all of us belong to. But tell me a little bit about that, because Brent was just talking about, you know, how there were some new people in the booths, which indicated some growth in the industry rather than seeing the same old faces all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it was that's true. I think most years, to some extent, that there's new PR people or there's new, you know, hires at different companies. But certainly it was very noticeable, I thought, on the press side that there's for the past few years have been very few new press people covering this part of the industry. I mean, there's certainly plenty of tech bloggers writing about Apple nonsense or doing terrible headphone reviews, but there's very few people covering custom install stuff. And the people who have been doing it have kind of continued doing it. And that's a little worrisome. I think that, you know, on that side of the industry, that's obviously inevitably going to have to shrink as people get older and retire and so forth. So it just was interesting that the younger crowd is not really covering this type of thing, which I guess makes sense. I mean, you know, if you're living in an apartment, why do you care about multi-room audio?
Well, true enough. Or big, gigantic projectors.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. What was your hit, Jeff, on the overall tone of the show? Did it feel more upbeat than in the last few years or not?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Brent. I mean, and you, that a few years ago, it was certainly kind of a we're all going to die mentality. And we've kind of bounced back a little bit from that. And it was, I would call it guardedly optimistic, would probably be the way I'd describe it. I mean, it was certainly, you know, better than a few years ago and maybe even a little better than last year.
Mm. Mark, as your first timer, first time there at the show, you don't have previous years to compare, but what was your impression of the general mood at the show?
I thought that the company representatives were enthusiastic. There were plenty of lines for what I guess you would call the good demos. So it did seem to me that if you were there and you had a legitimately interesting product, then there are enough attendees to keep your booth you know, humming along. And I think we ran into that in all of our videos. We had plenty of people even you know, cutting in front of our camera and popping out of doors. You know, I mean,
it's true.
I don't know. I would love to see it be even busier. I think that there's sort of an enthusiasm for 4K, if not as much 4K as people would like to see. That was one of the things that I kind of felt at the show, that people were looking to be blown away. And the people I were talking to were looking to be blown away, and instead what they were getting were the evolutionary improvements.
Rather than the revolutionary improvement that we expect sort of for 4K. Yeah. Well, that's a great segue into the next topic that I wanted to get to, which is what were the most important technology developments that we saw at the show? Brent, what would you say? You were covering audio pretty exclusively, right?
Yeah, I was completely covering audio. So were there any technological developments in audio?
You tell me.
Well, I can actually think of one. You know, we're seeing a lot more use of Class D amplifiers, you know, switching amplifiers, digital amplifiers, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
And that's become a lot more prevalent. And at this show, we saw even more of it. There was a new Lingdorf Audio digital amp, and they haven't done anything for a while. They've been sort of tied up with the Steinway Lingdorf project. But they have a new digital amp that looks really terrific. It's two channels by 170 watts, takes all sorts of different inputs. And you might remember that Tact audio amplifier from about 15 years ago, right?
I do.
Yeah. This is sort of like a new version of that. And there were a lot of smaller products that had Class D and very few receivers, but I just kept finding it used more and more. And I think that's a great thing for a lot of different reasons. Number one, you know, it's more energy efficient. You know, those things tend to idle at like a half a watt or something, you know, when they're not really producing sound. And, you know, they run really cool. They're small. They're a lot easier to install. You can shove them into a closet and not worry about ventilation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was probably the biggest trend that I saw in terms of audio technology.
You know, it's a very good point. We saw it also at Pro Technology, Pro Audio Technology, Paul Hale's company. He introduced a single rack space, 7-channel amp, which was all Class D, and with Paul's characteristic very low distortion and so on. I forget what the price on that was. I can't remember the model number either. Any of you guys remember that, Jeff? Did you get to Pro Audio Technology?
No, I didn't. I was doing mostly video stuff and the few new projectors at the show. I didn't cover too much audio.
Okay, well then let me ask you, what were the important technology trends or lack thereof in the video space?
Well, I think we're certainly in kind of an off year. The three big projectors for most people would be JVC, Sony, and Epson, and they all released new versions as we all expected them to. And in each case, they were all kind of the same as last year's models. I mean, the Epson 5030 is not really any different from the 5020, and then the Sony 55ES is not really different from the 50ES, and then JVC decided to one-up everybody by not even releasing a new projector in that price point, and so the X35 from this year is going to continue into next year. So hopefully we'll see more. I mean, I should say that the upper models of the JVCs, they are doing more of the E-Shift 4K or 4K, if you want to call it that. So that was an improvement over last year, where only a couple of the models had it. And I guess that is the biggest change for them, that all of the 4K or the E-Shift models, you can actually input a 4K signal now. So that's a big improvement.
Yeah, but you can send them a 4K or UHD signal now, but they're still doing an E-Shift thing. They're taking a 1920 by a 1080 panel and shifting the pixels by half a pixel very fast back and forth to simulate a 4K picture.
Yeah, yes and no. And I kind of am going to reserve judgment on this until I actually get one in and can put a 4K signal on it, because in theory that will work. I mean, DLP for a lot of years was doing half resolution DMD chips, but on the screen you'd get 1920 by 1080. And there was a lot of flack, myself and others obviously, saying, calling it wobble vision and everything else. But
because they called it wobulation.
Wobulation, right. So, I mean, but if it's done fast enough and it's done right, then in theory you could get a 4K or a 2160p image on screen. But yeah, I mean, there's going to be people who kind of say that that's not actually 4K, and there's going to, but I don't know. I'm kind of reserving judgment. I'd like to see it put some test patterns up there, because it's possible if you put up a test pattern, you'll get the whole resolution. It's theoretically possible. We'll see if it actually is possible.
Yes, we will. Mark, you had some interesting comments about the JVC 4K E-Shift. Mark and I got to see what JVC called the super secret footage. They had some 4K footage that they thought they had permission to show to use in their demonstrations, but turns out they didn't. So they kind of only showed it to a few select people, and we actually got to see it. And then we stayed and watched the regular demo that everybody else saw. Mark, tell us what your impression was of the super secret sauce versus the regular demo that everybody saw.
Well, certainly their secret demo was better source material.
Both of them, by the way, were sourced from a RedRay 4K server, which I thought was interesting.
It is, and I think that what they really wanted to do was simply show the footage that most flattered their projector. What we did see looked fantastic. I too would have to reserve judgment on exactly how much of that 4K resolution is making its way onto the screen. But the image could be described as better than 1080p, as in better than the 1080p that we get today. I think there's a tangibly good reason for that, because if you downscale 4K or if you reproduce it, I don't know how they're doing it exactly, but you know, there's more color resolution there. I mean, even if there isn't more total resolution because of the way color is compressed and sent through HDMI. So I think that might have been something that we were seeing, just the overall, you know, greater fidelity to the image. I mean, it looked great. I didn't dig the screen that much, but the projector itself was totally color accurate and had really incredible contrast, which I know is what they're most proud of. So, and my thought was that it, regardless of whether it's 1080p or actually 4K, it takes 4K signals. And in that sense, it has some sort of future compatibility that a straight up 1080p projector, you know, is an offering at this point. Because even though 4K content isn't that common, I would say that nobody's going to say that next year. I think next year we'll be swimming in it.
May it be so. The other thing at JVC that I found very interesting was that for the first time ever, as far as I know, the JVC has implemented a dynamic iris, which they call intelligent aperture, but it's a dynamic iris. Jeff, did you you went in? You probably saw the JVC demo, didn't you?
Yeah, I didn't get the secret sauce demo. I just got the basic demo, and I ended up kind of laughing at the end because they pulled a quote from one of my reviews, and then looking at it on screen, going, "Wow, what a terribly written sentence! Who the oh crap, it was me." so yeah, that was,
oh,
that was
man.
Fortunately, no one else in the demo recognized me. But anyway, I agree. I thought it looked great, and I thought the screen was a little, you know, a little sparkly. But yeah, I thought it looked. And
yeah,
I
forget what they were using. Oh. I think it was a reflection 170, something like that from Stewart. I think that's what it was. Had a kind of a high gain.
Yeah, it did. And I think it was a little bit too big for the projector, honestly. I think that's probably why, because it was why they had such a high gain on it. But regardless, I was sitting really close to the screen, and it looked, you know, you certainly couldn't make out pixels, which if I sat that close to my screen at home with a 1080p projector, I certainly would have noticed that being able to see the pixels. So that is at least a benefit, a slight benefit, you know, there. But yeah, as far as the iris goes, I have to figure that that's just either a marketing thing, or maybe their dealers are saying, well, everybody else has an iris, so we can't sell against it because yours doesn't. And it's just a line item because they've never needed it. And if you're just comparing on performance, then yeah, JVC is way better contrast ratio than anything else out there. But yeah, so there's really kind of no performance reason why they would need to do it. So that's my guess. It's just the dealer's saying, well, Epson and Sony have an iris, and that line item customers say they need it.
They were saying that the native contrast ratio of their top of the line flagship projector, the X900R, is 150,000 to 1. And you add the dynamic iris, or the intelligent aperture, as they call it, it goes to 1.5 million to one.
Right.
Now, I
think I've never gotten anything close to that when I've measured the JVC projectors. That said, the contrast ratios that I have measured from all of them have been significantly higher than any other technology. I mean, this year's plasmas come somewhat close, but more than even more than plasma or any other technology, that the LCOS, the way that JVC does LCOS, has easily the best native contrast ratio out there.
Right, exactly. And speaking of not being able to see the pixels, Mark, that was something I remember you saying to me right after that demo, was that, you know, it did look more finely resolved. Diagonal lines, you know, didn't have the jaggies that we might associate even with 1080p if you're sitting close enough.
The seamless picture. And I guess what I would say in addition to that is that same screen would benefit 1080p footage, definitely. It would just allow you to watch it at a THX approved distance, like 1:1 versus your screen width or whatever it is, 1.1:1, and not see any pattern. And yeah, that's a definite tangible benefit for watching movies today.
Yeah. iPhone Kiki in the chat room is asking an audio question, so let me bring Brent back in here. Any news about 3D type surround sound for home cinema like Dolby Atmos? There actually was some news in that regard, not about Dolby Atmos, but Brent?
There wasn't. There's a lot of, you know, honestly, I was paying attention mostly to speakers and headphones, which is my kind of focus. There wasn't an announcement about Dolby Atmos at this show. I think we can expect one in the near to not too distant future. You know, it seems like sort of an obvious thing, and Dolby's never, you know, always, you know, never tried to hide that they were going to do this for the home. What's the other announcement you're talking about?
I'm talking about Oro, A-U-R-O, which Barco. See, I thought Oro was a Barco technology, which in the commercial cinema, it's the competitor to Dolby Atmos, and they basically put a second row of surround speakers on the sides anyway, and then a center channel or an overhead channel, which is one channel but can feed multiple speakers overhead. They call it the Voice of God channel. And what we saw at the show last week was a company called Storm Audio has licensed Oro for home use, and also Datasat, which is either has it now or will soon implement it in its relatively new surround processor, RS20i, I believe the model number is. And so we are going to start seeing these 3D audio kind of technologies, this Oro, which I thought was a Barco technology, but it's not. It's developed by this company, Oro, and they licensed it to Barco for commercial use, and now they're licensing it to Storm Audio and Datasat for residential use in the home.
Yeah, it's all coming back to me now. Actually, I did visit Storm Audio, and that's a little bit different from Dolby Atmos, in that Dolby Atmos is, you know, what is it, 7.1 plus objects, which means they can do specific audio objects in the encoding. Whereas with the Oro thing, it's just more channels, right? It's like 11.1 or something.
I think it's something like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's fixed channel assignment. So, yeah, you have to have the speaker up above, and you have front height speakers, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I looked at it, got the pitch on it, and it seemed to me to be sort of how do I say this? Something that was demoable at a CEDIA type of thing, but maybe not something that was going to be easy to launch in the consumer realm. You know, you can always get somebody to put it into their surround sound processor, because so much of that is just DSP driven, and it's pretty easy to put the software in there. My guess is that it's going to be sort of an afterthought that'll be overshadowed by, you know, whenever Dolby launches Atmos for the home.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I've actually heard them both. Barco Oro is not widely known. I've only heard it once. I went and actually saw the same movie twice in one day because I could go see it in Barco Oro and Dolby Atmos, and I sure liked the Dolby Atmos better. But
it's just a much more powerful system.
It is. It is. Yeah, exactly. Still in all, to answer iPhone Kiki's question, I think that was iPhone Kiki. Sorry if I misremembered that. You know, we did see that. Also, Onkyo introduced a soundbar with sort of a faux 3D enveloping surround technology, which we didn't really hear. I mean, it was out on the show floor. There wasn't any kind of controlled conditions.
Yeah, well, that's sort of the latest trend in soundbars, is to put a 3D mode in there. And, of course, what does it mean? You know, you're still, in most cases, talking about a 2.1 device, maybe a 3.1 device. And in a lot of cases, you know, I just tested the new Samsung soundbar. I can't remember the model number, but it had tubes. And there's a new LG one that also has a 3D sound mode. I don't know if LG or Samsung did it first, but the other one was obviously going to do it if the one did it.
Right, exactly.
And I listened to both of them. And actually, if I recall correctly, in the Samsung, it was the best sounding mode, but it didn't produce, you know, flyovers or anything like that.
Right. It's going to be a pretty limited effect anyway, you slice it.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Samsung and LG, I wanted to make sure we talked a little bit about OLED, because LG was there, Samsung was not. But there's certainly a lot to talk about in terms of OLED. But before we do, I'd like to take a moment to thank a new sponsor for the show, and I thank them very much for being here. And that is iFixit. Now, iFixit is a great company. They're probably best known for teardowns of devices, but it's also an online community with over 10,000 repair guides for everything from your smartphone, computer, tablet, game console, to your home appliances, even your bike. It's like having a free repair manual online for everything. If you shattered your smartphone screen, you want to repair your game console, or maybe you need to swap out a battery on your tablet, iFixit has got you covered. They can even hook you up with the parts you'll need to do it, and everything they sell is tested and guaranteed. iFixit also makes the most trusted repair tools for consumer electronics, including the ProTech Toolkit. Now, I have to tell you, they sent me one, and I have been it actually came in really handy when I needed to change the batteries on, the RAM in my calibration laptop. So it comes in this great, I'm going to show it to you here, comes in this great soft case. It's got like, here, I got to make sure I get it into the picture here. It's got like 70 tools in it. It's upside down. Here we go. With all kinds of chip pullers and tweezers and a 70-piece ratchet set and screwdriver type thing. Tons of tools, exactly what you need to fix whatever you've got. I was able to open up the RAM sleeve, a part of my laptop, and do that very easily. So, I mean, it couldn't have come at a better time. So I'm very happy about that. This toolkit is, in fact, the gold standard for electronics work from everybody from garage hackers to the CIA and FBI. Holy smokes. But more importantly, their unique sets of tools are in service departments everywhere. It's ESD safe precision tweezers for delicate manipulation in watches and clocks. Anti-static wrist strap. I didn't show you that, but that's in there too, which is really important because you really don't want that static electric spark to jump around as you're working near very delicate electronics. So I do recommend it. I've actually used it myself, and it came in super handy. Saved my life, in fact, when I needed to upgrade the RAM in that computer. Now, this toolkit's only $64.95 and backed by a one-year warranty. Hobbyists and home DIY fixers also use the ProTech toolkit for doorknobs, eyeglasses. I'm going to need that eventually, I'm sure. Cabinet doors, sink fixtures, just about everything. Best of all, there are thousands of free iFixit guides to help you put your tools to good use. So this also addresses a very important issue for me personally, which is that repairing something is much better than throwing it away. You know, e-waste is a huge problem, and I try to keep my electronics going for as long as possible. And with a kit like this and all the online resources that iFixit provides, it makes it so much easier. Now, with iFixit, you can fix it yourself, as it has become clear now, I hope. Visit iFixit.com/twit for all these free step-by-step guides. iFixit also sells every part and tool you'll need. Plus, if you enter the code HTG at checkout, you'll save $10 off any purchase of $50 or more. That's iFixit.com/twit and use the code HTG. And we thank iFixit very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. So, as I promised, I wanted to talk next about Samsung and LG. I know, Jeff, you were at the LG event. They weren't on the show floor, but they, as they often do, had something off-site. And so you were there. Mark and I were there. Brent, I don't recall seeing you there. That was a video kind of a thing, so maybe you skipped it. And, of course, they had their curved OLED 55-inch screen. And Samsung, of course, has their curved OLED 55-inch screen. And so I wanted to ask all of you, really, what you think about this whole curved screen business. Jeff, let's start with you.
I think it's entirely just marketing. I actually got to see the LG close-up and the Samsung close-up at an event in August in New Jersey. Part of an article that's going to be running in Sound and Vision, I think, if not the current issue, the next issue. My thought, and this has certainly been kind of quietly verified, but not on the record, that The curve thing is primarily that they needed to differentiate the product. It's a $10,000 television, give or take, and they couldn't necessarily just sell it on picture quality. I mean, the picture quality is better than everything else out there, but picture quality has never sold a television. So they needed something to differentiate it and say, it's like, well, it's $10,000, but ooh, look, it's curved. The marketing departments, of course, are going to spin it as, well, it does this better and you get immersive and all that. It's a load of crap because you have to be sitting in such a very specific place to get the benefit that they're describing. Generally, it's just going to create distortions. So I would be shocked if we had many more curved screens. I mean, maybe we'll see another one or two at CES, but my guess is that this is just an initial fad of this beginning of the OLED technology, or at least the TV-sized OLED technology, and that at CES we'll see many more different screen sizes, but they're not going to be curved. That's my guess.
Mm. Mark, what's your hit on this whole curved screen business?
Well, we saw that Sony had a 65-inch LCD curved screen for, I think, $4,000.
And yeah, that amazing? 65-inch curved LCD TV, LED illuminated, as they all are now. For what did you say, $4,000?
I believe it was $4,000 or so. I don't remember exactly, but I also remember that that one can be hung on a wall, unlike the OLED. So I think what Sony did was they created that TV, maybe not to really sell, but maybe it was sort of as a statement like, hey, you know, OLED did this gimmick, but it's really not special because it's OLED.
Because we can do the gimmick too.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and for exactly. less and bigger and as it were, you know, yes, that's what people will look for if they were even looking for a curved screen. They're going to probably buy the largest one they can get that's the most versatile. That's my guess. Now, somebody who's looking for an actual OLED set, right now they're in an unfortunate situation because this is all that's offered to them. It costs too much and it looks silly. In fact, the thing that bothers me the most is it acts as a sort of a parabolic lens. And if there's a light in the background, it gets magnified. I mean, it's like it's a detriment, in my opinion, unless absolutely. You have it.
I totally agree. And I also object to the fact that the curved screen, particularly at the 55-inch size, encourages a solitary viewing experience because there's only one place you can sit. Jeff, you referred to this. There's only one place you can sit to get the optimal picture. And if you're anywhere else, the curvature makes the geometry of what you're looking at weird.
Yeah, and that it's even worse than – I mean, the LCDs in general have that same type of thing, that there's only a few seats that actually look good. If you're too far off axis, the picture quality disappears. But in that case,
it's because the black level works, does rises, and the colors shift. With OLED, you can go off axis, and the picture quality, the blacks and the colors and so on, it looks the same. So there's no off axis problem there. But you were about to say what the off axis problem is with the curved screen.
Well, yeah, now you're distorting the actual image. And not only can you not necessarily sit too far to the left or right, but you can't also move too far up or down. So you have to be sitting kind of exactly in the center, vertically and horizontally. It's just weird because if you're too low, all of a sudden, as a compatriot of ours, Gary Merson, would say that he was calling it the smiley face and the frowny face. That if you're too far in one direction, the top of the image looks a little smiley and the bottom of the image might look a little frowny if you're in one way. It's a mess. There's just no... The perceived benefit that the marketing departments are saying of having a more immersive experience is technically true of curved screens, very large curved screens. So if you have a 12-foot wide projection screen, then you could make a compelling argument that you'd want that a little more curved. But in a 55-inch screen, it just doesn't make any sense in any way.
Right. Right. I guess that's true. In fact, I know it is. Web 7277 is asking, why am I not mentioning that I did a whole episode on the Samsung OLED TV? Okay, I'll mention it. The last episode of Home Theater Geeks, Robert Heron and I spent calibrating Leo Laporte's Samsung OLED TV. He went out and he bought one. And he put it in his house. And we went and we calibrated it. And... What we're talking about here, the curved screen issue, really became apparent because Leo has it set on a piece of furniture, a credenza or something, whatever you call it, but it's too high. It's set too high for the seating distance on the couch that you're sitting on to watch it. So when he moves into his new house, I will recommend strongly that he find a piece of furniture that puts it at the right height for when you're viewing it. The other problem I noticed, and I want to say that while we were watching it, we were sort of looking up at it a little bit, and that distortion that, Jeff, you were talking about was really very apparent.
And both the Samsung and the LG, aren't they also both tipped back slightly?
Yes, that was exactly what the next point I was going to make. They are. They're both tipped back slightly so that if you're below them, they're sort of pointing up over your head. So it really isn't very good at all. Also, as I think Mark pointed out, the Sony curved LCD can be wall mounted, but these two OLEDs cannot, because they are permanently affixed to the stand that they're on. So, you know, LG and Samsung, I think made some mistakes. Jeff, you're exactly right. These are marketing decisions. They wanted to differentiate it from other flat panel technologies.
And when you look at it, the fact that it's an $8,000 or $10,000 television, I think a lot of these issues are kind of not irrelevant, but they're certainly less important, because anyone purchasing an $8,000 television is not trying to get the perfect picture quality. They're trying to buy an $8,000 television, you know? So for that, I mean, it's almost just like a piece of jewelry or something at that. Like, okay, look, it's neat. It's curved. I have something different. I have something better than my neighbors. I have whatever. And these are all perfectly valid reasons. If that's what you're going for, you know, go for it. But, you know, but when this starts coming down in price and they're flat and they're big and they're gorgeous, then I hope that we'll see Samsung, LG, Sony, Panasonic, whoever, that the picture quality aspects of these will become more interesting to us. Because that's one thing I did notice with the Samsung when I saw it in New Jersey, was that it's just the picture quality is ridiculously good. It is so much better than everything else out there.
Yeah. Yeah, and I noticed that too when I did calibrated Leo's TV, was that other than the curve, it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. The blacks are nearly zero, which means the contrast ratio is nearly infinite. And the colors were gorgeous. Grayscale calibrated beautifully. I mean, it all just went great.
Yeah, now it's interesting that the LG, on the other hand, although still very good and puts out a very good image, in a lot of ways was not quite as good as the Samsung, at least in the samples I've seen and a few of the reviews that I've seen of so far, where there's little things like uniformity and a couple other like image retention and so forth that LG was problems with the LG that weren't with the Samsung. Not sure why that might be. They certainly are using different OLED technologies, so maybe that's part of it, but I wouldn't necessarily say that's definitely it. I don't know. I can't wait to see more of them, basically, and see how they shake out.
Now, Mark, you commented to me at the LG thing. That was your chance to see the LG OLED, and you had already seen the Samsung at the Samsung event. And your impression was that the LG's curvature was less than the Samsung's, right?
It was definitely my impression. I thought that the LG had a curve that was similar to what I saw on the Sony, and that the Samsung's curve was very obvious, relatively. Like, I found with the LG, I could almost ignore the fact that it was curved if I was relatively centered. With the Samsung, it was like just curved from every angle except that perfect center point.
Right.
But I don't have proof. It's just what I remember, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my impression as well. And I mean, the only way to really know would be to somehow measure it. Certainly the manufacturers aren't going to tell you what their curvature is. In fact, LG said to us, we said, what's the curvature? And they said, well, we're not really saying.
There is some information out there. I mean, I've done a couple articles on the curved aspect, and they're a little more, I think they're a little more upfront about it than that. I mean, they might not have said it at the event, but I wish I could remember the actual numbers, but I'd actually found out and dug around a little bit and figured out what they were. And I almost want to say that one of them was 5 degrees and the other was 7.5 or something like that. But, but yeah, if you dig around, there's certainly a little bit of information out there. A few people have actually just gone and calculated it out.
Yeah, I was actually trying to think how I would do that. What measurements on the TV would I need to actually calculate the curvature? I'm still working on that angle. It's a little bit of a mathematical puzzle, which I enjoy. So, Brent, let me bring you back in to just tell us what other audio demos you heard. What did you think sounded really good? What did you think not sound really good?
Well, let's see. My favorite was probably did you see the Constellation Audio and Magico demo?
Yes.
That was pretty awesome.
I did hear that.
That was more than $500,000 worth of equipment. I know the amps alone were like $170,000 just for the amplifiers. So it should have been good. And, you know, it was $72,000 worth of subwoofers, which is just two of the Magico subwoofers.
Right. Right.
So that had to sound good. And it did sound good. The thing that really surprised me the most was the Definitive Technology Mythos, the STL, I believe it was called.
I believe that was their new speaker there, yeah.
Right, new tower speaker, $5,000 a pair, and it has a built-in bass section, you know, woofer section, with 1,200-watt amp. And, you know, they've had a version of this speaker kicking around for a while, but this one's substantially upgraded. And I got to tell you, I just thought it sounded fantastic. It sounded it sounded like there were two pretty good subwoofers in the room. And it also had a giant, big stereo soundstage and just fantastic fidelity. That was my favorite. That was probably my favorite sound of the show, you know, all things considered, taking price into account and things like that.
Right, right. I mean, did you think it was equal to the Magico demo, for example?
No, but, you know.
$500,000 versus
$500,000. So no, it wasn't equal, but it was, in its own way, more impressive, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of Definitive Technology, they were over in the sound room section. Did anybody else hear the Definitive? I didn't. I don't think, Mark, you did either, right?
We didn't get a chance to get back there.
No. Jeff, how about you?
Yeah. I heard a couple of things, from their booth, the new, STL tower speakers, I think is what they were.
I think that's what we were just talking about, what Brent was just mentioning. Yeah.
Yeah. They were fantastic. They were really impressive. I've certainly heard a lot of DefTech speakers over the years, and they've never really, I've liked them, but haven't loved them. But these, even in that little room on the show floor, they just sounded incredible. They did a really great job with these.
Well, now I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to get back there. I did hear the Golden Ear Technology new in-ceiling speakers. Did you guys hear that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that's actually a model that he's had around for like a year or something, but they never demonstrated it before because it's so hard to, you know, those showroom those show floor demo rooms are made of this sort of prefab stuff that they all basically sort of snap together.
Right.
And it's really difficult to demo like any kind of ceiling or in-wall speaker in those rooms. And I know the Golden Ear guys were really complaining about it, but it was worth it because to me it sounded it's important to point out this is a speaker that's really been carefully crafted. It's got that little Heil type tweeter that's been so popular with the Golden Ear and Martin Logan products. And I was when I closed my eyes for a second, I thought it was the sound sort of floats down a little bit, and mm-hmm. Subjectively, psychoacoustically. And I thought it sounded really good. I thought it sounded, kind of like a Golden Ear speaker. And it's important to note just because it's an option most of us don't ever consider. And yet if you have a significant other who doesn't want any speakers, or let's say you have one of these designery kind of rooms where it's all, maybe your floors are made of, I don't know, whatever they're making high tech floors out of these days.
Right.
And, you have this sort of pristine decor with a couple of fancy paintings and stuff. And yeah, maybe you don't want a pair of speakers in that room. And with these speakers, you could put these up there. They're $500 each. They're not even really expensive. And you can have pretty darn good stereo sound without having anything that's even slightly visible.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought they sounded really good too. Speaking of psychoacoustically making the sound seem like it's coming from somewhere than where it's actually coming from. Mark and I were sat in on the Prima Cinema demo. Now, Prima Cinema was over on the other side of the hall, and this is a company that delivers first run movies, and I mean while they're in the theater, they're released day and date. You have to buy their $35,000 server, and then they will let you buy rent really the movie file for a movie that's actually in the theaters at that moment, and you pay $500 and you get to watch it once within a 24-hour period. And they vet you. They screen their owners before they let them, take on this service because they're so afraid of piracy, of course. And they also demand that you have certain level of sound quality. And in the booth, they had, in their demo room, they had a Meridian sound system. And Mark, I want you to explain what they explained about the center channel speaker, which I thought was so funny.
Well, they felt that there would be superior sound performance by having the center channel speaker be underneath the screen instead of using an acoustically transparent screen.
Right.
And at that, they certainly bragged that they were requiring the users to get equipment of this incredible quality level, and that that was going to be part of the total value, the total like real movie theater experience that we were going to get for that. Presumably $500 and a fingerprint scan, and
That's right. You have to authorize the playback with a fingerprint scanner.
Yes, to prove that you're in the room when you're watching it.
Right.
So ultimately, there was an issue because when there's that kind of a buildup, you do expect to be blown away, and I would say the opposite happened to us, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I would. I was particularly thinking about that center channel speaker, which was placed under the screen. And the demo guy said, that it was designed to lift the sound up so that it sounded like it was coming from the middle of the speaker, which reminded me of what Brent was saying. It kind of didn't do that, did it?
No, there was a muddy sound field. Pretty much every other sound field we heard in all the other projectodomos were superior regardless of the equipment used in terms of spatial separation and having that center channel carry the center channel content dialogue, whatever. It just didn't happen for me. I would be disappointed if I owned that system at any price.
Yeah, really. Brent, did you get in to see the Prima Cinema demo?
No. I got the pitch. I was outside and I got the pitch and I was just like,
oh, they tried to draw you in, huh?
Oh, I just thought, well, I mean, look, I don't know how many people there are that would want that. Well, there's lots of people that would want it. How many people would actually pay for it? Yeah, of course I want it. You kidding? To actually pay for it is, there's some people in LA here, there's movie industry people who are loaded with cash and would want that. But the number of people I think is so small that would actually be interested in that I just thought my work would be better served by going to hear another set of speakers.
Jeff, did you get into Prima Cinema?
No, I mean, it's certainly, I agree with Brent, that there's going to be a certain number of people who want that and are able to afford it at the same time. And other than the obvious significant upfront cost, I don't know, $500 doesn't actually seem that ridiculous to me. If you consider, somebody has a big family and they invite some friends over, say there's 10 people in the room, that's, $150 to $200 easy that you would be spending on a ticket, not to mention popcorn and everything else. So, not too ridiculous at $500, but that's not anything I would pay, but I can see how other people might.
Well, plus the fact that it's 1080p, it's not even 4K.
Wow. Yeah, well, I think most the installed base at this point is going to be 1080p. Who knows if what will be in a couple of years, but getting that, prying that content out of the studio's hands that's the difficult part in any resolution.
Right. Right. That's exactly right. Vince360 in the chat room says, aren't movie tickets up to $500 already? Almost. next stop for us is headphones. But before we do that, I want to take another moment to thank our second sponsor for the show, which is ProXPN. Now, ProXPN, of course, is a virtual private network that works with almost any internet connection. It provides a secure, encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, email, file sharing, instant messaging programs, anything like that. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes, disguising your physical location and giving you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. You get complete online privacy with a 512-bit encryption tunnel, which should keep most hackers at bay, I would think. And it works via OpenVPN or PPTP. You get to choose. You can protect yourself against your ISP's six strike rule and keep your personal internet usage private at work. And I think that's very important. You can bypass internet filtering and blocked websites and bypass geographical restrictions, even more important, for webline for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the US, UK, Asia, and more. In fact, ProXPN makes your internet connection truly region-free. ProXPN software for Windows and Mac offers advanced controls, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. It also works on your iOS or Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy on the go. In fact, there's a new ProXPN app for Android in the Google Play Store that supports OpenVPN. Our own Steve Gibson has given it a great review on Security Now. So go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year, but we've got a special offer. Use the promo code HTG and receive 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month for the yearly plan. And if you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the promo code HTG. And we thank ProXPN very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire Twit network. So, Brent, I wanted to touch a little bit on headphones, and I know Mark's got something to say about this too, but we'll start with you. What did you find in the world of headphones that tickled your fancy?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot. NAD showed their new, NAD, being associated with PSB, showed their new in-ear monitors, which I don't think they'd shown before. I didn't actually hear them. They told me, oh, we'll just send you one.
I'm not sure I'd want to put in-ear headphones, earbuds in my ear at a trade show.
Yeah, well, at like Rocky Mountain Audio Fest, which is coming up for a couple of weeks, usually the guys have big bowls full of those things. So you can slop them out. But right. They weren't really, they were pushing the over-ear model from NAD, which I think is called the VP40, VH, HF50, that's right.
Which is under their VSO brand name, I think.
Right, exactly. And it's important to note these are designed by Paul Barton, who's the brains right. behind all the designs of PSB. And, right. Great, fantastic audio engineer. There was that. There was a new Focal showed two new ones. They have one called the Spirit One now, which is pretty well received. And they showed a new professional version that looked really cool that had, designed for more of a flat response, sort of a studio monitoring thing. And it also had detachable. It came with a 1 meter cord that had the remote for your phone. And then they had a 4 meter coiled cord that also attached to it. So it would really work like a studio phone. They also have one called the Spirit Classic, which was sort of just a more high-end version of the Spirit One with a lot of leather and that. I mean, it looked nice. What else did I see?
Leather ear cups probably felt good too.
Oh yeah. It was really comfortable. The Monoprice has a new Bluetooth headphone for 70 something. What more do you want to know? $70 and change. And it looked, I kind of thought it would be really cheap, but I put it on and it was really comfortable and shockingly well made. And it has a built-in micro SD card holder. So you can play music off of a micro SD card with it. So you don't even need your phone something happens to your phone. And, for $70 some odd dollars, really amazing. I didn't hear it because, you know, it's the showroom floor. I don't listen to headphones on the showroom floor. But that was pretty great. And I don't know, maybe somebody else heard something else. Like, those are the ones that stick in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I remember you were commenting how much you liked the PSB M4Us, which are not new at the show, but I think it was the first time you'd heard them.
I like them, and I also tried on the NAD Visos, and I had brought these Pioneers with me, and I also had these MDR 1R Sonys with me, so I had a reasonable fresh audio memory and a point of reference. They were great headphones, both the NAD and the PSBs. Full bass extension, you know, and with the modern design where you can plug in on either side and swap the cords out. But primarily that they were comfortable, sealed cans with full extension and a really smooth response. So I think Paul Barton really knows what he's doing when he designs those headphones. Made me a little bit jealous because I had some nice headphones with me. Those seem to perform even better.
Yeah. Now you're a fan of those Pioneers, which have come down in price. They're like $50 on Amazon or something, right?
Sure. Yeah, but they're open back headphones. They don't, and all open back headphones ultimately don't have really deep, you know, bass response. What they have instead is that open, airy, you know, clear sound. I guess when I was wearing you know, Paul Barton's headphones, I felt like the soundstage itself was also nice and expansive the way you'd want, you know, or what I look for in a headphone, which ultimately leads me to listening to open backs, also like these AKG 701s. I do love my headphones.
Yeah, so. you're a pretty serious headphone guy, I know. And also a serious subwoofer guy.
Yes.
So tell us what did you find that was interesting in the way of subwoofers?
Well, that Wisdom Audio demo, that was interesting because those subs were truly tight. I'm not bragging in saying that was the standard of bass that I personally want in my system. I think I get very close to that. The rest of the show, I think we heard some flabby, tubby bass. I mean, maybe they're having a hard time because of their enclosures, you know, not being like real rooms or whatever have you. But when it came to the subs, I was most impressed by the Wisdom Audio setup, and that certainly was powered by Lab Groupins. There were these gigantic transmission line subwoofers all throughout the room. I don't know how many watts.
Oh, speakers, not subwoofers.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Subwoofers are transmission line. I'm sorry, my mistake. I made a mistake. They had four of their big subwoofers, which are transmission line. You're exactly right. I was mistaking that for line array, which was what their main speakers are.
Yes, they are. And then they showed us the 150 amp line that they were powering. but what I really liked about it is the way that the bass notes, I mean, you know, there's no distortion when you're really feeling it, but you're hardly hearing it. You know, when you've got deep bass, it should really have a like a thunder strike. I mean, you should be able to just feel it intensely and not have it be like blah blah. I felt like so many other demos were not that tight, and that it handled film content and music with equal aplomb. You know, that demo really stuck in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Notch. Now, the other demo I'm thinking of bass-wise is Pro. Is it Pro Audio?
Pro Audio Technology. Paul
Technologies.
Hale's group.
Yes.
With that gigantic 24-inch subwoofer.
Right. So they had us listening to two 24-inch subwoofers that were ported models using Pro drivers. And while they generated some bass levels that I would say were very intense, you know, they're, I guess I would say it wasn't as tight as what we heard in the Wisdom Audio demo. And we had some discussion about the usefulness of being able to reproduce bass, you know, below 20 hertz or not, which that particular system wasn't really designed to do.
Right.
I think maybe something was missing there. Certainly there wasn't anything missing from 20 hertz on up. You know, that's for sure, though.
Yeah, it was a very clean sound. Jeff, did you get into Pro Audio Technology?
No, but when you're talking about transmission line subwoofers, I couldn't help but remember back in my home theater days, I built a transmission line subwoofer out of a 12-foot piece of sonotube and a single driver. And
I remember that. There was a great photo of you, sort of a fisheye photo of you standing at the bottom of this 12-foot column. That was hilarious.
Yeah, that was a really fun article. And Mark Peterson, who's the audio guy, we're still doing work for them. He helped me out with it. And we ended up measuring it. And the disturbing thing was that I built this thing out of basically $100 worth of parts. And it measured better than a multi-$1,000 subwoofer we were featuring in the same issue.
So, oh, man.
But to go back briefly to the headphone thing,
please,
I cover a lot of headphones for Forbes and Wirecutter and stuff. And Brent and I had actually an interesting discussion because we both loved the M4U2 and the M4U1 headphones. We gave the twos.
PSB.
The PSBs, yeah. We gave the twos a Product of the Year award. I gave the ones the best $300 headphone on Wirecutter, and they're still the best, I think. But we had an interesting discussion a couple days ago because Brent had the NAD headphones, and it's very clear that even though Paul Barton designed both of them, they are a little bit different. And Brent, and obviously you can ask him directly because he's right there on the screen.
But
when we were listening to them back to back, Brent said at the time that he kind of preferred the NADs, and I could see why he or people would like that. I tended to still prefer the PSB sound to it. They are slightly different, and I thought that was really interesting.
Given that they're saying, designed by the same guy.
Yeah. But I can't wait to hear the in-ears. I'm much bigger fan of in-ear headphones because I tend to walk around with a lot and just have in-ear headphones. And that price point, there's some really good headphones at that price point. I think they're $170. So I can't wait to hear those just to see what he can do with a nice little in-ear.
Brent, what is your take on the NAD versus PSB that Jeff was just talking about?
I'm just finishing my review for stereos.about.com right now. It's a matter of personal opinion. I like the NAD a little bit better. The PSB, which I can't say I really heard this when I originally listened to it, but the NAD kind of puts it in perspective. The PSB has a little bit of a kind of a bass resonance, a little bass hump, if you will, somewhere around like 100 hertz. I can't remember. Yeah, I measured these all at some point or another. And with the NAD, that's gone, and the bass is a little smoother and a little less unrealistically punchy. However, the NAD also has a little bit more of a treble peak. So it's, apples and oranges and kumquats and whatever.
As much as I like a little extra bass good bass, I really hate treble push, especially in certain frequencies. It just kind of pierced my brain. And certainly the NADs weren't that bad, but they did have that little bit extra on the top ends that I just really like. I'm okay with it on the NADs, but I didn't love it. And that's where the PSBs I thought were a little smoother in that regard. But I agree with everything Brent's saying. It's completely a preference thing. They're both fantastic headphones.
Well, in the last couple minutes, then, I want to ask each of you, what was your favorite audio demo and your favorite video demo? Jeff, let's start with you.
Well, I didn't hear too many of the audio demos. The Mythos STLs were certainly, for real speakers, were amazing. But it's not probably what you were asking, but the DevTech, they also are making this thing called the Cube, which is a 7.5-inch square cube with six drivers in it, about 80 watts. And it's a Bluetooth speaker,
little handheld portable thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's handheld, but it's handheld like a toaster is handheld. It's not really, it's big, but big-ish, 7.5 inches. But I liked the design of it, and it sounded cool. I mean, I can't wait to actually hear it. I already wrote it up for Forbes, actually, just like a preview type thing. I thought that was a neat design way to go with it. And as far as video, probably either the JVC stuff looked really good, and the high-end Sony 4K stuff, of course, looked great because it's, full 4K, and they were running 4K on it. And but at 15 grand for that 600 ES projector, correct, it better look good.
we hadn't mentioned that up till now, and I want to make sure we do, that Sony had their next generation lower cost true 4K 4096 by 2160 projector, the VPLVW600ES, for $15,000 or $16,000 if you want to get it with the server, the media server that you can download 4K movies into, which is $10,000 less than the previous generation. So we're moving in the right direction, and I agree. That was a that was a really great demo, particularly the 4K material that they were showing on it. Brent, you've only got probably audio demos to cite, but what was your favorite audio demo there?
Oh, gosh, you know, there were a whole bunch of good ones. I said the Magico Constellation one.
Yep.
I saw the Pro Audio demo, the Paul Hills thing, and that completely blew me away. I love the Steinway Lingdorf demo. The Wisdom demo was great. I didn't see the JBL demo, sadly. Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
If your screen is vibrating and shaking the picture, maybe your demo's too loud.
And certainly the Paul Hales, the Pro Audio Technology demo, did do that. And I agree with you 100% on that.
I heard JBL did too.
Yeah, Mark, isn't that right? Didn't JBL do that as well?
It was shaken, for sure. I saw a lot of shaking screens.
There were a lot of shaking screens going on. There was a lot of really high-level stuff. The Pro Audio demo, the Thriller cut that they did, Paul measured it at 110 dB average. Jeez. Wow.
That is excessive.
Yeah, seriously excessive. Okay, Mark, give us your pick for best audio and best video at the show that you saw and heard.
Well, I could start with the best video, where I would concur on the Sony VPL600ES. That was that looked perfect when it was showing true 4K content, and it looked really great showing Spider-Man. I actually was on AVS and somebody was asking if there was motion judder, and I said, no, I think what we were seeing was a high shutter speed and 24p being rendered almost too realistically. But yeah, I felt like that projector really does it for me. It brings movie theater clarity, and I saw nothing to object there. I already said that I liked that Wisdom Audio demo, and I'll have to stick with that because I relate to all the concepts, the design concepts that they're using there. I mean, it's sort of like now would be a dream system for me to have, and it's the only thing there that I heard that I'm gonna just go ahead and say it that I felt I couldn't achieve at home. And the only other demo that I've heard, we didn't listen to this time, that I think had that kind of clarity with in terms of surround sound and all that, would actually be Krell and the Foundation processor that they have. I mean, just and it's interesting because, you know, we got to see I think the demo reel from Skyfall, the shootout scene at the end several times.
Yes, during the show. A lot of people were using that as demo material. It's true.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, just to give you mine, I agree. I think probably the Wisdom Audio demo was my favorite. Really, really clean sound, very low distortion. As you say, tight bass, well-defined. I thought the Pro Audio Technology demo was also excellent in terms of sound quality. Bass wasn't quite as well-defined possibly, but again, very, very low distortion. The DataSat, we didn't even talk about the DataSat processor, and that's a really cool piece as well. And that they were using Triad speakers and DataSat amps, and they sounded really good. The Magico sounded really good. As far as video, I agree. The Sony 600 looked great with 4K material, and upscaling, it looked really good too. I thought the video in the Magico room, which was provided by Display Development, which is basically a Christie projector, also looked fabulous. It's 1080p, so it wasn't 4K, but I thought that picture really looked great as well. Okay, so we've certainly covered a large amount of CEDIA, not everything, of course, but you know, what can you do in 1 hour? So, but I want to thank all of you for being here and doing a wrap up, especially the day after we all got back. I'm sure. You guys are wishing we had a day off, but no rest for the weary, I guess. So anyway, Brent Butterworth is at stereos.about.com. And Brent, do you have a Twitter handle? I didn't get that before the show.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Jeff knows. Jeff might know.
Yep. It's Brent Butterworth, but without the H.
Thanks,
Brent Butterworth. Butterworth without the H? Is that what his Twitter handle is?
Yeah, so it's Brent Butterworth.
Okay, well, very good. Yep. There you go. Jeff Morrison is at CNET.com and Forbes.com and Wirecutter.com and just about everywhere else on the net you can imagine. His own website is Jeffrey. Yeah, I say right. JeffreyMorrison.com and his Twitter handle is TechWriterJeff, and that's G-E-O-F-F. Finally, Mark Henninger can be found at AVSForum.com and the Twitter handle AVSForum. He writes a ton of stuff there, and I'm so happy to have him on board with me at AVS Forum. Thanks a lot, you guys. Really appreciate y'all being here.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
You bet. You can, of course, find me at avsforum.com, where we have many video interviews, as I mentioned before, from Cedia. Do hope you will go check those out. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott and also at AVS Forum. You can find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg or on its YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Anthony Grimani, a world-class acoustician who we met up with at Cedia. And I invited him to come back next week to talk about all things room acoustics. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.